So we're going to sing Step by Step. This tune was adapted by Pete Seeger and Waldemar Hill from The Prairies They Grow Small. The words were adapted by Pete Seeger and Hill from the 1864 preamble to the Constitution of the American Miners Association. Feel free to sing along with us as you listen.
Step by step, the longest march can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly none. And by union, what we will yet can be accomplished still. Drops of water turn a mill, singly none.
Greetings, listeners. My name's fellow worker Gordon. I'm a member of the Tacoma General Membership Branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. I live in Bremerton. I'm a retired shipyard worker, and I'm a participant in this WOB radio show. So going around the table, I'm going to hand you off to our guests who are sitting here and going to be commenting on events of the day. And to my left is fellow worker Noah.
Nice to meet you. I'm fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns, and I've been part of the Tacoma IWW branch since about March of 2021. I am also a delegate as well, so both me and later Marilyn, when she gives her introduction, if you're interested in signing up for the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, if you reach out to us, you'll get linked up with either one of us, and we can help you get signed on to the union and show you how to organize. Passing on introductions to fellow worker Lynn.
Hi, I'm Lynn, part of WOB Radio, and it means wobbly, which is part of the IWW. We have this WOB Radio show to educate and entertain people in the audience who might be interested in unionism, current events, and history, too. I'm a current member of RPEC, which is Retired Public Employees Council, and that's connected with AFSCME. I've been part of AFSCME and various unions through the years, my working life. I'm a retired social worker and medical interpreter. I'm in part of IWW. I'm the treasurer of the local branch.
And I'm fellow worker Marilyn. I am a retired community mental health worker. I used to work with teenagers and children and families, and I've been a member since I think about 2008, and I'm a delegate. If you're interested in joining up, you should know that we have a sliding scale membership fee, or if you're listening from prison, you don't have to pay at all, and you can join the IWW. Glad to be part of WOB Radio, and also IWOC, the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. That is the group that's here today. We're missing a couple of members, and you will undoubtedly get to hear from them when they come back.
For our next section here on WOB Radio, we are going to go ahead and read you a section of the preamble to our Constitution given to us by fellow worker Lynn.
We find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class. The trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions and they aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. These conditions can be changed and the interests of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry or in all industries, if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all.
And that's why we're called the industrial workers rather than the trade union or the craft union workers.
Now we are going to move on to the next section of our radio show. We are going to be reporting on some local, national, and global labor news articles to keep our workers informed as to what's happening on the picket line and in the shop. Our first article that we have here is coming out of the SEIU and AFT. So this is being reported on by Northwest Labor Press. It's one of the local news sources specifically centered around working class struggles and the labor movement here in the Pacific Northwest. This was posted on February 2nd, 2024. The SEIU and the AFT have joined a call for a ceasefire in Gaza. This article was by Don McIntosh. Service Employees International Union, the SEIU, on January 22nd, became the fourth national union in the United States to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. And on January 30th, the American Federation of Teachers became the fifth. And this is a quote. As a union family strongly committed to justice and democracy, we believe all people across the globe deserve to live safely and free of fear, with dignity and respect for their human rights, as well as access to food, water, shelter, medicine, and other necessities, the SEIU said in its statement. The statement condemned the horrific attacks by Hamas on October 7th and the widespread attacks on innocent civilians, including the bombardment of neighborhoods, healthcare facilities, and refugee camps by the Israeli military. This article continues on to state, the AFT statement also called for an end to politically motivated attacks on universities in the United States. Quote, teachers and students must be free to express different views on the burning issues of the day without fear of loss of position and retaliation and without intimidation and threats of violence. The other unions to call for a ceasefire are the United Auto Workers, the American Postal Workers Union, and the United Electrical Workers. Dozens of local unions have also issued statements, including some in Oregon and Washington. I think this is a pretty cool development in regards to labor news because, as we've previously reported on, other major unions in the United States and around the world are calling for a ceasefire in Gaza to the humanitarian crisis and the genocide that's occurring there. And I think that these are two other big unions who are finally stepping up to the line and saying, enough is enough.
I'm surprised that the journalists haven't called out yet because over 100 journalists have been killed since October 7th.
Most of them Palestinian.
Yeah,
no,
absolutely.
All over the world.
Yeah, but a big percentage of that number, I think, is Palestinian. I heard that in
And then try to tell me that a child is an enemy combatant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the inhumanity of that and bombing hospitals.
There is a committee, I believe it's called the Committee to Protect Journalists, and it is a worldwide organization, and it has journalists from every power block. And they're after just that, and they have been vociferously protesting what's been going on. It doesn't get to the mainstream media.
Right. Well, and the thing that I'm sure the listener is aware of it, but I'm just going to say it, journalism has become a very dangerous profession.
Yeah. Oh, indeed. Not just in war zones, but in just general political discourse. Journalists are being arrested for all kinds of trumped up charges, like espionage and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so the CPJ and other outfits, and in the United States, the ACLU, they're out there trying to defend journalism and journalists' rights, but they're having a hard time of it.
You know, last year, when I went to Norway, the recipients of the Nobel Prize were journalistic groups.
Hmm.
They were recognizing the work that journalists do and the peril that they're in.
Yeah.
And trying to report and preserve memory of what has happened and what is going on.
Mm-hmm. Those are hard lessons.
Yeah.
Fellow worker Lynn is going to go ahead and report on the Washington Conservation Action and Evergreen Workers Union finalizing their collective bargaining agreement.
Yes. I had never heard of this union. It's small, I believe, and it's connected with Washington Conservation Action. And the Evergreen Workers Union got their first contract, and it goes through 2025. WCA represents, and Evergreen, represent a healthy and equitable workplace. The whole purpose of the Environmental Workers Union and WCA is environmental justice. Workers who are, they prize an environment of the workplace where workers are valued and empowered.
And I'm actually reading the article right here as well. The Evergreen Workers Union has stated that this is an exciting step forward, not only for us, but for Washington's environmental, labor, and progressive movement as a whole. By coming together in solidarity, we are organized to fight a more just, equitable, and sustainable future. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. I'm also thinking, as I'm listening to you, Lynn, that a group of people working for environmental issues very often are working for nonprofits. I'm going to say, quote, nonprofits. And quite often the employers of nonprofits use that to try to discourage unionization, because we're all doing this because we're paid volunteers, basically. But they use that to keep wages down and to discourage any kind of speaking up for better working conditions. So this is very good.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have heard in the IWW from other branches and other outfits across North America that some of the toughest places to organize, yes, are nonprofits with a, you know, a warm, fuzzy feeling about them, like mm-hmm. the ASPCA or something like that. And some of those outfits, because they're nonprofits and because they're fighting for some kind of moral cause, fail to recognize that their workers got to eat and that their workers need job security and fair pay and all the other stuff. So it's like, it's surprising in some ways, but in other ways, not. So if you're working for a nonprofit and you want to organize, just be advised that you have all the right in the world to do so.
I'm going to give you a personal example. I worked for 25 years for a nonprofit known as Comprehensive Mental Health. And they were some of the worst exploiters of their workers. Just, I want you to wrap your head around this. Any of you that were born at 9/11, when that happened, Comprehensive took that moment of silence in Tacoma to call workers in and lay them off.
Really?
And that's a mental health facility that did that.
I also just wanted to mention, there has been a history of trying to organize nonprofits, even environmental nonprofits, like the Washington Conservation Action. I know a fellow worker in North Seattle who's a member of the Seattle branch up there, who's done a lot of labor organizing with the IWW over the years, and one of the campaigns he actually participated in was trying to organize Greenpeace volunteers.
Oh, yeah.
I believe it was in the early or mid-90s to try and have the environmental unionism aspect of the IWW incorporated into that workplace.
Absolutely.
And they put up a really, really tough fight. A lot of these nonprofits are just as able to hire labor consultants lawyers to try and bust unions.
Yeah. I tried to organize Comprehensive. Mm-hmm. We took it all the way to a vote. It was a tie.
Mm.
And a tie goes to the employer.
I believe in an organization which is self-funded by membership. I contribute to it. It's called Charity Navigator.
Oh, yeah.
And it evaluates the different, not only nonprofits, but organizations that purport to be charities, etc., and do good. And it's interesting and enlightening to look up one of these under Charity Navigator and just see what proportion of what they raise actually goes to the cause. Mm-hmm. And that's how the organizations get 1, 2, 3, or 4 stars. And you mentioned the ASPCA. Those are different from the humane societies. And I've looked them up, and they're not worth contributing to, although it's a great cause, and my heart goes out to it. But mm-hmm. There's a lot of organizations that deserve support if you have any extra money. And I just give $5 a month to several. But, you know, and there's so many that are 4 stars, so I don't give to any that get fewer than 4 stars.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. just a tip, a lot of people don't know about that resource. Mm-hmm. For when you give to charity, you want to give wisely.
Oddly enough, years ago, when I was working for the federal government in the shipyard out in Bremerton, they have an annual event called the Combined Federal Campaign. And that is sort of an umbrella if employees wish to contribute, you know, to organizations. And they have an actual pamphlet that comes out that is pretty thick. And it's got all kinds of some very odd charities, very specific niche charities. But the thing I'm trying to get across is that, okay, this is 20 years ago and more, that in this pamphlet they would rate these various organizations as to how much money went to their overhead.
Yep.
And things like 25, 30%, 40%, that means 60% of that dollar that you contributed isn't going to the people, that it's going to padded executive salaries.
And that's what Charity Navigator sorts out.
Right.
For the searcher.
I was kind of surprised that it wasn't, you know, because that was my whole career. I worked there 31 years, right? So the thing was is that I wasn't aware that any of this kind of stuff existed on the outside of that envelope. And I'm glad that Charity Navigator exists so average people can say, like, for instance, The Red Cross.
Oh.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, they pay like 40% of their donations, it's a nonprofit, to overhead, to their execs.
Look what happened during Katrina. Where was the Red Cross?
Exactly.
And then there's the not-for-profit places, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what are they? It's like they're tax-exempt, I think. I don't know enough about this to comment, but makes me think of it. Not-for-profit, all these big hospital conglomerates, they're, quote, not-for-profit.
Right. Yet they can compensate their executives in the 6- and 7-figure range.
I should look up if there is a legal difference between non-profit and not-for-profit, because
mm-hmm.
both of those expressions are used, and I see that they're not used interchangeably.
I hadn't noticed that. I thought that they were synonymous.
All right. Fellow worker Gordon, you had an article about the crisis in the Teamsters.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about this because, well, first of all, let me give a shout-out to the guy who wrote it. His name is Joe Allen, so I'm going to be liberally sampling his writing, so I don't want to get accused of plagiarism. But he's a fine writer, and he's working on the Counterpunch website. And Counterpunch, as the name implies, is a left-wing organization, but it's an independent, more like Noam Chomsky-oriented type socialists and anarcho-syndicalist type thinking. So they're a good outfit, and you can check them out online. Just go to counterpunch.org. But anyway, Joe writes, he says, last summer, the Teamsters were riding a wave of goodwill and favorable publicity. And if the listeners remember, we've been talking about reformism going on in AFL-CIO unions. And I myself was, you know, really supportive of Teamsters for a Democratic Union. Well, guess what? The old monster of corruption rears its head. And so he says after that, the union's year-long contract campaign at UPS raised expectations for a potential transformative national strike at the country's largest private sector employer. Much of the U.S. left, especially the Democratic Socialists of America, encouraged dozens of their members to get jobs at UPS, while over 100 of their branches pledged support for their Strike Ready campaign. And, you know, I support our brothers and sisters in DSA. They've got their hearts in the right place. And they were trying to do like workplace organizing, but they kind of lost their way with this because expectations collapsed quickly when a last minute deal was cut between Teamsters General President Sean O'Brien and UPS negotiators that, while notable for some important wage gains, struck many people as underwhelming. Many of the younger radicals, and they're talking about the DSA people who salted into UPS. And salt is an expression that some old-time labor organizers might remember. It's like deliberately joining an outfit so that you can create trouble. So they did that, and they hired into UPS, and they got very disappointed because many of the younger radicals that got jobs on some of the most socially isolating shifts at Big Brown, meaning UPS, were left confused and in some cases very demoralized by their experience. While Vote No campaign failed to catch any traction. The Teamsters contract campaign, while notable for its bloviating, looked hollow compared with the UAW stand-up strikes against the former Big Three automakers that soon followed the deal cut between UPS and the Teamsters. Okay, now here's the disturbing part. The president of the Teamsters Union, Sean O'Brien, who was a Teamsters for a Democratic Union candidate, reform ticket, he's courting the far right, including meetings with Ohio's J.D. Vance and Missouri's Josh Hawley, senators from those two respective states. Former President Donald Trump at his seaside Mar-a-Lago estate, that's no good, has not been addressed, but this issue has not been addressed publicly by those on the U.S. left who spent the last several years promoting him, led by the Teamsters for a Democratic Union.
Wait a minute, what about Mar-a-Lago and...
They went to, Sean O'Brien and a delegation of Teamsters went to Mar-a-Lago.
Are you kidding me?
Not according to Joe Allen, not according to, you know, what was in the news.
Oh, my God.
I know. And it's like they're openly courting the MAGA movement, you know, and to me, that's like betrayal. And I guess to...
It's not like betrayal. It is betrayal.
But I can imagine what many of the younger, especially the younger Teamsters who were in on this reform movement, how they must be feeling about it, knowing full well that Donald Trump and the MAGA outfit, they do not support organized labor.
Well, no, duh.
And so, you know, one would think that was a duh, an obvious, but it ain't, apparently. And this is a very disturbing trend.
So are they being called to account by the membership?
Well, this article was just published 2 days ago. And so he has been researching it. And I would imagine, yeah, there's another outfit called TM, not Transcendental Meditation, trying to find what the TM stands for. But it's another reform outfit, way smaller than TDU. And so they've been trying to get the union to vote for a ceasefire in Gaza. Teamsters won't do it. Teamsters Mobilize is the name of this new faction. You got to understand that some of these big unions have scores of thousands of members, 20, 30, 40,000 members. Some locals are that
they're
big.
They're bloviated.
Well, they're bloviators indeed. But what I'm getting at is that you can get lost in the shuffle, mm-hmm. and little factions can develop, and you know, you won't know about it. You're busy working. Well, this evidently, this emerging crisis in the Teamsters Union became visible to the whole world on January 31st, last Wednesday, when The Guardian revealed that a racial discrimination lawsuit by former Teamsters International organizers was recently settled by the union. Settled pretty quietly, right? And Joe refers back to Sean O'Brien's home local, which is, I think it's Local 25 in Boston. And they have a bad reputation of being, you know, racist and pretty rigid in their, you know, membership and everything like that. But this, he says, none of this bodes well for the future of Teamsters for a Democratic Union. It was upheld for decades as a model for rank and file reformers to emulate. But it doesn't have any reason to exist anymore. So this new outfit called Teamsters Mobilize, much smaller network of Teamster activists, they're the ones calling for $25 an hour for temporaries and a ceasefire call for Palestine and Gaza. So the crisis in Teamster leadership threatens to overwhelm recent strike victories at DHL, another package carrier, and U.S. Foods, as well as local organizing campaign in Virginia at Costco. So this has a lot of implications, and it really shows that you know, the old guard is still very active, and most of our trade unions and AFL-CIO affiliates, we just got to keep up the struggle to reform these older unions and get them to be more democratic. It's really surprising to realize that you can't vote for your union steward, and you can't vote for your local president. In some of these national and internet, you can't. They're not democratic. The IWW and unions like UE are some of the few that democratically elect their stewards. I was a machinist for 30 years.
So who picks the stewards?
Oh, the General Executive Board. Yeah. And
pick up.
Yeah, higher ups, basically. The good old boys, the guys who hang out in the tavern with the local shop steward. That kind of thing. And the bigger the district, like 751... that's Boeing, and they have thousands and thousands of members. This is something that we in the IWW have been preaching about since 1905. However, you know, we support union organizing across the board. Anybody is welcome to our solidarity and our support, but we have to be really careful and look carefully at national and international leadership to make sure they're not backsliding on us and not having lunch at Mar-a-Lago.
And, you know, speaking about, you know, reforming the trade unions and a change of tactics and the power of the rank and file to kind of overhaul these institutions, that's going to be my book report later. I have a wonderful book report about class struggle unionism by Joe Burns.
Okay.
And it basically talks about how there is that growing movement to kind of either kick out the old guard or completely reform unionism in America as a whole to prevent situations like this.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I've heard of that, and I welcome it for sure, because, you know, you have experience with working in a union shop and mm-hmm. how difficult it is to break into it, and sometimes if you work for a union shop, you gotta join the union. That used to be a winning thing back in the 1910s and 19-teens and 20s, is that prevented scabs from being in your shop. but it got, you know, twisted and misinterpreted over the decades, so that now a closed shop is not that good a thing anymore, because it depends on your union leadership. If they're corrupt and you must join the union to get the job, that's a bad situation.
I mean, my first union job was also the Teamsters outfit here in Tacoma. It wasn't so much the union stewards or the leadership that particularly turned me off at the time, but it was a lot of the people working in this union shop just, you know, when the seasonal hires or the new young hires got signed on, they were like, they told them, don't join the union. It's just a waste of your dues, you know? They don't do much for us. And it was kind of like, oh, wow, there's a big disparity between a union which is trying to democratize the workplace has a victory here in a contract and, you know, these bureaucratic process to make sure that happens. And then on the other hand, there's a bunch of these older workers who have been at this shop for a long time just saying, no, we don't really see anything out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very exemplary of that kind of divide with you have these quote-unquote democratic principles being exercised through a union, but then you have a lot of people who are supposed to be participating in it not finding any outlet for it.
Right.
I mean, you could even take that up to American politics as a whole. The same thing kind of applies.
It's true, because I've done both. I went to a few machinist meetings, and mindful of the fact that it was a federal local, so we were kind of looked down upon by other machinist outfits because we couldn't go on strike. You can't go on strike, you're useless. But we defended a lot of workers and everything like that. But so few people went to the meetings, and we had hundreds and hundreds of members. And because the meetings were run in a very Robert's Rules of Order fashion, and any objection, no objection, seen, so carried, you know, this kind of thing. And it really turned a lot of people off, turned me off, because I had anticipated, oh boy, I'm joining the machinist union, you know, and we'll be struggling on the waterfront for workers' rights. Nah, it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they become corrupt, because being a union steward is a privileged position. You don't have to work as hard as the regular guys on the line, so that's just a reality.
That's one hell of an article you got there.
Oh, yeah, it surprised the hell out of me, because I started reading it and said, God, I remember defending this whole, you know, Teamsters for a Democratic Union thing and making that a pivotal part of my arguments for, you know, unionism and to support other unions, and now it's kind of like a stab in the back. Mm-hmm. It's a betrayal. But we won't dwell on that, because I got some good news, and this involves the IWW, and it's my fellow workers out in Kitsap County. I'm going to read this report by fellow worker Rob, and he and a bunch of other fellow workers from Bremerton and Kitsap County have been supporting the Starbucks Workers Union at several stores in Kitsap County, notably in Bremerton, in Silverdale, and in Polesbo. So on Saturdays, we're leafleting. We have our own leaflet. The Starbucks worker, SWU, has their own leaflet. And we're just talking to people in the, what do you call it, the takeout line, you know, the window and everything. And the people are pretty amazed. And Rob says, Wobblies of Kitsap County, who are in the process of establishing the first branch in the peninsula's history, have been engaging in a solidarity campaign with Starbucks Workers United. For a little over a month, they've been spending their Saturday mornings agitating in front of a series of Starbucks, educating customers to the anti-labor, union-busting practices the company has been engaging in. The call to action is for customers to scan a QR code on a flyer that they're handing out at these stores that points them to the Starbucks complaint line, and I'm going to give it to you. It is 1-800-611-7792, and that's the Starbucks company complaint line. So call them up and complain.
One more time.
1-800-611-7792. And you can voice your support for workers' efforts to organize and to demand the corporate office negotiate in good faith with the unions. The reaction has been overwhelmingly positive, and I think Rob means the reaction from the customers that they've been talking with people expressing surprise or ignorance, followed closely by anger to the tactics Starbucks has been using to stamp out workers fighting for their rights. Through the national efforts of encouraging boycotts and educating customers on the 330-plus federal labor law violations Starbucks has been found guilty of, I guess by the NLRB, Starbucks stock has dropped 12% in the last 6 months. Yay!
Good.
To the lowest market share since they began trading publicly. So workers have power. Yeah.
You know, I'm really glad to hear that after the betrayal in the article before.
Yeah, that's what I'm...
Yeah. Thank you.
I got this all arranged here, fellow worker.
You're ending it on a high note.
I'm trying.
Thank you, fellow worker Gordon.
One more thing. It says the campaign will continue into 2024. That's now. Saturday mornings at rotating standalone Starbucks locations across Kitsap. Until demands are met, Starbucks corporate show the proper respect to the only people who are actually creating value for the company. Visit the Bremerton Kitsap IWW Facebook page or email bkiww@protonmail.com for more info and how to join them. And please be advised that we're in the process of changing our name from Bremerton Kitsap to just Kitsap because we didn't want to appear too, you know,
narrow,
siloed. You know, we didn't want to say that this is all about Bremerton. Go ahead.
Could you repeat that website, please?
Sure. It's Bremerton Kitsap IWW Facebook page, okay? Or you can email us. We just set up an email list, bkiww@protonmail.com. Proton like in the nuclear particle. We'd be happy to welcome any inquiries. And if you're out in Kitsap County on Saturday, come on by and talk to some Wobblies. Take a leaflet. Show your support for our Starbucks workers, fellow workers.
What is happening on this side of the bridge with Starbucks workers being in solidarity with the ones out in Kitsap?
I have no clue. I don't know.
I personally haven't heard much about it, frankly.
Well, that's the thing. They don't communicate one with the other because it's dangerous.
Oh.
People get fired, you know, and people put on really rotten schedule. You know how they can retaliate. So this is one of the things that's difficult in labor organizing in general, but for IWW in particular, because we need to discuss very honestly with people we're trying to organize or who want to organize with us what can happen. And that's part of what we call the inoculate phase of AEIOU that fellow worker Noah went over several broadcasts ago. Mm-hmm. But it's just like a little mnemonic slogan we use to keep our heads in the game. You know, it's agitate, educate, organize, inoculate, and unionize. And the inoculate part, which has always got me, is what the hell do you mean by that? We're going to give people shots, you know? And it says, no, that's just being honest and warning them, mm-hmm. you know, that this, that, and the other thing can happen. You know, they've been union busting, they've been doing this, that, and the other. So be prepared. If you're ready to take action, then we're here for you. But, you know, just be aware that it has consequences.
Inoculating basically means eat their pizza and form a union anyway. The pizza's there to talk you out of it.
There you go. I like that.
Yeah. So, no, that's a fantastic report from Kitsap County.
Thank you.
And I mean, I was saying earlier that I would love to have a few fellow members here to do an interview to talk about what the process has been like to form a branch, because mm-hmm. that's something that doesn't really happen that often, even in the major trade unions,
right.
that a new branch of a union or, you know, in a particular trade or industry gets formed. I think it would be fantastic to talk to them.
I have already put out the possibility. I've been getting more active on our Discord platform, and people are coming up with really great ideas. We have a fellow worker who is very well-versed in using a computer for radio broadcasting. Okay, so I'm in on that. Also, I broached the idea of going to the, whatchamacallit, to the local community access TV station and volunteering. And, you know, we'll lug cameras and microphones and stuff around, you know, as long as we can learn how to live stream and learn how to take good video. So we're discussing that. And we're discussing, sorry, fellow workers, we're going to start our own radio station.
No way.
Way. But what we'll do is that we'll definitely get some of the fellow workers who are interested in this and who want us, and already I've had some feedback. Mm-hmm. And they would love to come and participate in our broadcast.
That's
so
terrific.
It is. And I'm very heartened by it that, you know, I say WOB radio, and you can picture some guy in a shack, you know, with a green shade on and all this radio equipment around him. No, it's a little bit more modernized these days. See, it's changed a lot since I was in the Army. So I was really gratified as to the interest and also the ideas that came back. And I have one more brief announcement.
Go ahead.
Okay. Rumor has it, and I have not verified it, although it looked like it was a legitimate IWW publication online. But I've heard that the IWW has been rechartered in Aberdeen, Washington, which has been like a holy grail, because Aberdeen had a big wobbly branch back in the day, and of course was viciously suppressed back in the 1920s. So if that's true, that will make Aberdeen the westernmost IWW instead of Kitsap. Go ahead.
I'd like to make a minor correction. Aberdeen and the Hoquiam area there on the coast actually had some of the longest living IWW locals through the early 40s.
I didn't know
that. In the lumber industry.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. There was a large amount of Finnish and German immigrants and Norwegian immigrants as well who moved out there to take part in the early lumber industry in the early 1900s. And they were so militant and so popular, they actually lasted essentially up to the beginning of the Second World War.
That's pretty cool.
Well, you know, some of the little ethnic halls that were set up all throughout Washington, like the Sons of Norway or this, that, or the other, they were also Union halls.
They're wobbly front groups.
Yeah. Slavonian Hall.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Finn Hall.
In Aberdeen and Hoquiam, there was the Red Finn Hall.
Yes.
That's what it was called.
Ooh. Yeah.
And some of our most effective and some of our most militant organizers from back in the day. So if this is true, and I hope it is, road trip to Aberdeen. We're gonna see our fellow workers out there.
We'll stop at Kitsap along the way.
Yes, we will.
Moving forward, I, fellow worker Noah, would like to give another book review. On WOB Radio, we like to give a book review every episode to kind of give our literature recommendations for anyone who wants to read more into labor organizing or the philosophy and ideology surrounding labor organizing, especially from an IWW perspective. And a great book that I have been flipping through recently, I will admit I only just started reading it page for page, but I flipped through this book and I have to say it shows an exciting vision of the future of labor organizing and unionism. This book is called Class Struggle Unionism, and it's written by Joe Burns. And this book was published by Haymarket Books, which is one of my favorite book publishers. So to read the back of the book, just to give you a brief description, class struggle unionism is the belief that our union struggle exists within a larger conflict between an exploitative billionaire class and the workers who actually produce the goods and services in our world. While workers create wealth, the outcome of the wage employment transaction is the separation of workers from that wealth and the creation of the billionaire class. From that simple proposition flows a beautiful and radical form of unionism. So this book is really talking about how the past few decades of labor organizing has kind of been mired by stagnation and internal corruption, and a lot of the major trade unions, they're fine with making contracts with employers so that their workers can get more in terms of wages, hours, and benefits, which a lot of labor organizing focused conversations tend to focus on, but it completely ignores the fact that there is a more and more powerful group of employers, the billionaire class, as they call it, that are essentially controlling more and more of people's time, of their ability to labor in exchange for better wages or just a better quality of life in general. And this book really brings it to focus that the labor movement is part of a wider class struggle between the working class and the owning class. And I think that that's pretty fascinating because, if I can read a section of the preamble here very quickly, like what fellow worker Lynn said at the beginning of the episode, we, the IWW, find that the centering of the management of industries into fewer and fewer hands makes the trade unions unable to cope with the ever-growing power of the employing class, and that they foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. This book alludes exactly to that. It also alludes, and I'm going to cite the preamble again really quickly, these conditions can be changed in the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department, therefore making an injury to one an injury to all. And again, this book kind of leans into that idea that we are all a wider body of workers no matter what trade or industry that we work in, and we all need to stick up for each other whenever one group is harmed. So to give kind of a few quotations from this book, the first one that really jumped out to me It was actually a quote by Karl Marx, which is pretty surprising for a book about labor organizing, because you don't think of a lot of American workers don't typically think of unions as being quote unquote radical organizations. They kind of have this almost managerial or bureaucratic image to them, which has kind of been fostered by the past 50 or so years of labor organizing. So it starts out with a quote from Marx, and then it goes forward to say that what Marx is pointing out in his analysis is that by calling the transaction a contract and making it appear totally voluntary, it really obscured the fact that part of the labor expended by workers was being taken by the owners of industry. This analysis is the starting point of class struggle unionism. If one accepts this wage transaction at face value, then our job as unionists is merely to try to help workers sell their labor at the highest price possible. But under that framework, once the sale is complete, the right of employers to manage the workforce is not contested, and neither is there complete and absolute control over the business and profits. This section goes on to state, class struggle unionists, by contrast, question the entire framework. Why do those who do not produce the work get to keep all of the value created? Workers spend a good portion of their waking hours at work, so why should they not be treated like free people? Or as labor's anthem, Solidarity Forever, which was written by a very famous Wobbly, points out, if it is we who plow the prairies, built the cities where they trade, then why do we stand outcast and starving midst the wonders we have made? So that's the starting point of this book. And it actually, throughout the course of this book, frequently name drops the IWW as kind of an example to look forward to in regards to how the trade unions should operate.
I noticed that the Central Labor Council here in Tacoma, as of the last 2 years, instead of feeling like they're in competition with industrial unionists, i.e. the IWW, have started looking into and adopting a lot of the concepts that we have. Mm-hmm. Now, it's slow going because it's a huge group composed of many different labor unions. Their historian, especially when he's come to different events, has mentioned that industrial unionism is an effective way to organize.
I've always maintained that the difference between business unionism and industrial unionism is that business unionism wants a bigger piece of the pie. Industrial unionism wants the whole goddamn bakery. And by that I mean, we're out for a societal change to build a new society within the shell of the old. Whereas trade unionism, business unionism, although it can be reformed and tweaked, has no fundamental different vision for society.
They're capitalists.
Yeah.
Well, I would say that they have a pro-capitalist view of labor organizing.
Right.
And I will agree with fellow worker Gordon on the point that the big difference between the IWW and the business unions, or the trade unions as they're more often called, is that what is the actual future vision mm-hmm. of the trade unions?
Right.
It's to establish more organized shops. It's to get workers organized so that they can get a bigger piece of the pie. But then what? All they look forward to is the next contract negotiation,
right.
The next delegation of union stewards.
Whereas the IWW talks about workers own the means of production.
Exactly. We have a different vision of labor and society as a whole that we are trying to build towards. We actually do have end goals that we want to reach that mm-hmm. will shape society and not just renegotiate it so that you can get a slightly higher wage, which is good. Don't get me wrong. I appreciate it when my wages
sure.
go up.
Everybody
but
does.
Again, what this book is pointing out is that the actual structure of work, how work is managed, how the conditions of work is decided, only very rarely gets tweaked. The business class keeps all the goods, keeps the means of mm-hmm. production, and the workers get slightly more of a pittance out of it, even when they do really fight hard
right.
to try and organize and make their workplaces more quote-unquote democratic.
Well, another problem that we're experiencing in our modern society with the advent of the cell phone and laptops and computers is that there's no longer a clean separation between work and your non-work hours.
Mm-hmm.
That you can still be working because you're tied to your phone and they can call you in or ask you questions or ask you to do things for them in non-working hours. So the workers are giving more and more of their labor, which is not being officially recognized.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, actually, there's a fantastic term for that, not from this book, but from another author who, unfortunately, my brain is currently forgetting. They actually came up with a term for this, subemployment.
Wow.
Oh. Or as we call it, wage slavery.
Or wage theft.
Yes. Where basically more and more people, especially in underprivileged communities or in refugee camps or in war-torn countries, are getting employed by these big outside capitalists so that, hey, they can have a form of work, you know, they can still make some money on the side, but it's at just a low enough pay rate that they can't qualify for any kind of unemployment benefits wherever they live. But it's not enough compensation so that they can actually enjoy the freedom of the rest of their life. AI is actually a big section of the market nowadays where subemployment is big because they actually have to hire people to recognize what's a face,
yes,
what's not a face, what looks like a motorcycle in this little CAPTCHA image that you have to fill out in order to enter your password, what doesn't look like a motorcycle. That's all being done by people. People have to recognize those images and tell the computers what to do. And a lot of the people that do that is subemployment.
That's the grunt work of AI.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's terrible. I've read something about that. Another point about industrial unionism, quickly, if I may. We've talked about it almost every episode, how the IWW and other unions like it, like some of the old CIO unions, sort of had built into their structure at least the idea that women and that other races, minorities, ethnic groups, built into this, that, you know, we have no place for prejudice and bias in our outfit because we're trying to make life better for everybody. Whereas in the trade unions, they can be misogynistic and they can be racist. The other big point is that we recognize that, you know, current industry is destroying the planet. And we're not going to, you know, ask for more pipelines in the IWW. We're not going to ask for more polluting industry. We're trying to work towards being in harmony with the earth. And that's another very big point about industrial unionism.
And actually, to touch on the topic of anti-racism and also by extension, it's February, it's Black History Month.
It is.
This book, Class Struggle Unionism, like I said earlier, puts the IWW kind of on a pedestal as an example for anti-racism within the union movement. And here's a quote. In the early 1900s, the industrial workers of the world developed in large part due to the racist and exclusionary practices of the American Federation of Labor. The IWW opened its doors to all workers and offered a different path for the labor movement on race. The IWW even attempted to establish interracial unionism in the Deep South, while at the time the AFL unions were mired in white supremacy. In Philadelphia in the early 1920s, the IWW established an interracial local that for over a decade was able to maintain control of the Philadelphia docks on a class struggle union basis.
Shout out to fellow worker Ben Fletcher and Local 8 of the Marine Transport Workers Union.
And that is a big part of our history, and one of the big examples that we in the IWW talk about is that that was one of the first really large interracial unions that was ever formed in this country. And Ben Fletcher really helped with a lot of the organizing because it was a group of black dock workers getting together with a bunch of white, predominantly immigrant, but still white workers who benefited from the white supremacy of the time to get together and say, look, if we all fight for each other at the same time, we can all get, you know, not just control of the docks, but a better way of life.
That's it.
And it's a huge example that we try to highlight. This book also goes on to talk about IWW tactics as well. In the early 1900s, with the AFL refusing to organize the masses of industrial workers, workers in unskilled positions wanted to fight but simply could not do that through the exclusionary AFL locals. Some of the great strikes in labor history came out of this upsurge, with the IWW providing important leadership. Long after the IWW waned, their influence remained in the battles of the 1930s. A full assessment of the IWW is beyond the scope of this book, which I kind of wish it did expand a little bit more on it, although it is one of the great examples of a class struggle approach in U.S. labor history. So to give a better definition of class struggle unionism, about fighting for the entire working class, and this is in Chapter 4 of the book, class struggle unionists, in contrast, believe in something bigger, and frankly more inspiring. Seeing labor struggle as part of a broader working class conflict They link labor struggles with other fights. They fight for the unemployed, for single-payer health care, and for issues benefiting the entire working class. But it also means that class struggle unionists fight against attempts to divide the working class, such as racism, sexism, and anti-immigrant policies.
Yep. So, boy, does that ring a bell today.
Absolutely. So to kind of wrap this up, I highly recommend this book. And again, I've only just started reading it page for page, but just flipping through it, and the fact that it's been recommended by Sarah Nelson, the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, the CWA, Barbara Madaloni from Labor Notes and the former president of the Massachusetts Teachers Association, and Carl Rosen, the general president of the United Electrical Workers, the UE. This is a fantastic book showing a portrayal of what the future of labor organizing could look like as a broader class struggle.
Would you please repeat the title of that book?
One more time. It is Class Struggle Unionism by Joe Burns, and it is published out of Haymarket Books, one of my favorite publishers.
Is that your personal copy?
Yes, it is, but if you'd like to borrow it, by all means.
When you're done with it, could I borrow it?
Absolutely. All right, so in summary, that's my book report. If you want to listen in to more literature recommendations from our Tacoma branch of the IWW, we always have this section in our WAB radio broadcast, so feel free to listen in on the next episode, and we'll give a shout out to another great book that you might enjoy.
I'm just going to start out, so we don't need any big introduction. We're about to talk about police unionism, and I think that that's a contradiction in terms. Police like to say that they have a union. They call it the police union, but in my opinion, that is a police guild, not a union. Mm-hmm. And the IWW also takes a stand on this. They say any worker is welcome in the IWW except members of the employing class and members of the police organizations.
Law enforcement and also correctional officers.
Because the job of the police and the law enforcement is to protect the property of the ruling class. Mm-hmm. So that is my opening to police unionism and the struggle for criminal and racial justice. I'm throwing it open. People, just chime in here with what your opinions are.
I think one of the biggest cases that we can highlight talking about, you know, police unionism and why it poses such a struggle for the labor movement is that there is a stereotype about unions typically used by people who are anti-union or organizations who are anti-union, which is that unions only protect the bad workers from getting fired and prevent the good workers from getting more in terms of a wage increase because they're held back by wage negotiations. I think the ironic thing about police unionism is that this is one case where that actually happens. Police unionism exists to defend members of police organizations and correctional facilities from having any kind of actual legal or even just internal accountability in general. I think one of the biggest cases that's coming out of Tacoma right now is the Manny Ellis case, which just recently concluded in the courts. All three of these officers were found not guilty for the practices which were approved and employed at the time when Manny Ellis was murdered by three Tacoma police officers. And then later on basically said, because these police officers are now voluntarily leaving TPD, they have to get a payout for that. Each one of them is getting $500,000 just to quit their jobs. Mm-hmm. And they're having their legal fees recompensated. And while they were in court and not actively serving as police officers, they were also getting paid for that as well.
And how long is that? Like 3 years?
Well, he was murdered in March of 2020, and it was just a few weeks ago that the officers got off scot-free.
They got their wages that whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and a monetary award, apparently.
Oh, unconscionable.
And to cap it off, for those of us that live in Pierce County or Tacoma, guess who's paying their wages? We, the residents and taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
And if I ever wanted to say not in my name, now would be the time.
Absolutely. And like you said earlier, the IWW recognizes this very real problem of trying to include police and correctional forces and unions. Mm-hmm. Because like you said, as they are in this country, they exist to protect the property of the employing class and the will of the employing class, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a very popular slogan that I've seen floated around the internet, which is that the compensation for a crime is a fine, then that law only exists to punish the working class and not the employing class who can get away with paying a small fine.
Even a big fine. If I can pay, you know, if Dow Chemical or whatever can pay a $5 million fine for polluting an entire neighborhood and not have to correct it, you know, that's nothing for their bottom line.
It's like the auto industry when they found those problems with exploding gas tanks. Mm-hmm. They decided, you know, they did a evaluation that it's cheaper to just pay each individual one than to change their whole car system.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, hey, it happens in the labor movement as well. When employers illegally fire their workers for either being suspected of or actually being part of a union campaign, all they get is a 4 or 5 digit fine from the NLRB, and then they have to hire on that employee, which they will later find a reason to fire for other reasons that they'll try to justify. So, yeah, and I mean, bringing it back to police unionism, I think that, especially with the AFL-CIO, a lot of the police unions started in the 20s and 30s as kind of their way of getting into the labor movement, partially to change the direction from it has been the long-term consequence, but also at the time because there wasn't really a clear picture of what do police officers work for? Are they a part of the employing class? Are they against the employing class? Obviously, the IWW very much disagreed on that point. But yeah, I think that it poses a huge problem because it protects the worst workers of that industry, something which unions are often scapegoated for. They basically act as a legal guild to protect those bad workers from any kind of accountability. And in the case of Manny Ellis, it helps people who kill people get away with it scot-free. So the heck do we even do about this?
Just imagine, I mean, who are the first people, if you decide to have a walkout at your place of business, let's say you work for a hospital, and you and other employees who are not doctors or part of the professions, the cafeteria workers, you know, the medical assistants, you know, the maintenance workers, all of these other people who are not doctors, and you decide to have a walkout. You decide that you're going to, you know, make a point by walking off the job. Well, who's out there to meet you? Well, it's the police. They call the police first thing. Mm-hmm. We want to keep these people in line, keep them in order. When a couple of Octobers ago, out in Kitsap County, we had a demonstration against the Salvation Army, because they were throwing people out of the shelter for, you know, because they had drug problems. Guess what? You know, a lot of people on the street have substance abuse and other mental problems that need treatment, not punishment. But the Salvation Army was throwing people out. So we had a, long story short, we had a demo out in front of a local event center, the Admiral Theater. You've probably seen commercials for it on TV these days. And they sent the cops right down there. And the cops made the mistake of talking to me. And I told them that, you know, these are younger people who were not in, you know, not used to or experienced with walking a picket line. That's what we were doing. And I said, officer, this is a moving picket line. We are not obstructing entrance or egress to the facility. We are not disrupting their ability to make profit. This is under United States civil service law, United States labor law, and civil rights law. And the guy said, okay. It was pretty amazing. You know?
Less paperwork.
Yes.
But that highlights a very important point about police unions. And I think this is kind of the big point in my personal opinion, is that police unions are a way of using unions against unions.
Exactly.
Like you said, whenever there's a picket or a walkout or a strike, it's the police who's called to it first.
Yep.
There was that movie we saw out at the Chuck about those immigrant workers in the hospitality industry who went on strike, and they picketed and protested in the streets. They did marches on the boss and things like that, and it was the police who were beating and breaking them up.
Yep.
And so, you know, and then the police unions come forward and they say, well, we had to break a strike. They were causing a civil disturbance.
Right.
You know, they were breaking noise violations, things like that. So we had to go out there and use legal violence against them.
Yeah.
And it actually reminds me of this old, I think it was actually published in the Industrial Worker ages ago, back in the 20s. But it was the irony of the police unions marching in the Labor Day parades and then the very next day breaking up a strike.
There you go.
People right. trying to organize.
It's cognitive dissonance, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's something that the AFL-CIO has been very slow or even hesitant to address.
Right.
Because I don't think that they really have a full comprehension of how that creates an internal conflict.
Hey, when your business model is collecting as many dues-paying members as possible to pad your expense account and to pay for the Ferrari, you know, it's going to run into, you know, logical contradictions. You can't have your cake and eat it too. Either you're supporting. And the funny thing is, back in the day, there were some police departments that went on strike. Mm-hmm. I think Boston, unbelievably, the cops went on strike.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM, KTAH.
And that's what created all the Hatch Act type laws that you can, you know, certain government employees can't go on strike, you know, by law. But before it was made law, it happened. And it disturbed, you know, the powers that be and the people who paid for the cops, which is the capitalists and the industrialists. So they've jerry-rigged it, and they have made the labor law to accommodate police unions. And when I say police union, it's in air quotes. But it's logically contradictory. You can't be part of the labor movement and be cracking heads on a picket line the next day.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, I also, bringing it more to more recent events, talking about all of this kind of makes me realize the irony that a lot of the big trade unions here in the U.S. and around the world are actively protesting and calling against the government and calling for their labor unions to call for a ceasefire in Gaza,
yeah.
Which a hyper-simplification would be the over-policing of the Israeli state against native Palestinians on their own land.
Oh, exactly.
And at the same time, when it comes time to discuss what the police unions are doing in the, you know, trade unions, nobody really bats an eyelash.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I don't know. Like you said, there's kind of a cognitive dissonance there that there is a group of people who enforce bad labor laws, who break up strikes, who commit violence against striking or walking out workers, are completely allowed to sit in the same labor halls the next day to talk about what wage increases they want or what funding increases they want from the local government. It's
well,
wild.
It was pretty controversial in the IWW, you know, because and it's a valid argument. Hey, look, we say we represent all workers. You know, they didn't say all workers except. And that was truth. And a lot of people, just on that principle alone, were saying, no, we can't say anything about the cops having a union because, look, we wrote this. So we modified the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
which is a democratic thing to do. We did it a couple of conventions ago, I think. And that was to specifically state no law enforcement and no correctional department personnel are allowed to join the IWW as if you were a boss because you're defending the boss. And so you're right out. And I think we're the only union to have done that formally. Maybe UE or some other independent. And shout out to UE. They're the last standing CIO union that didn't purge their leftist leadership in 1954. So shout out to UE and its president and its rank and file. But you know, I think cop unions are a logical contradiction.
Backing the police is so common across the country. I mean, everyone remembers Tamir Rice mm-hmm. and just the absolute insanity of that. And the guy was
yeah.
cleared. And he'd worked for other police departments and had failed the psychological tests, I think. And his shooting ability was less than. And then he shot a kid to death. And then he was probably hired at another county or city.
Yeah. And the police unions definitely help with making police officers who shouldn't go on to do law enforcement work continue mm-hmm. law enforcement work. And I'm sure that these three officers who murdered Manny Ellis are probably going to find another police job in another city where they're able to keep working.
Yeah. As if nothing had happened.
Although I did hear that our Attorney General wants to do an independent investigation
mm-hmm.
and open the case. And also Manny Ellis's sister is pursuing a civil lawsuit against the three police.
Yeah.
Which, so it ain't done yet. But you know who we never hear about is Joaquin Saeed, who was killed in Lakewood by cops, sort of that same period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So
we had one in Kitsap County, too. We had a Native American guy get murdered by the police up there.
Mm-hmm.
He was being disorderly, or he was being, you know, something they didn't like.
Right.
But I think he was just a big Indian guy that they didn't like, and mm-hmm. he ended up dead. And so this kind of behavior is incomprehensible and it's not forgivable.
So I'm going to bring up the million-dollar question.
Uh-oh.
Which is that, you know, you've mentioned, fellow worker Marilyn, that, you know, the Attorney General is looking into the Manny Ellis case, Manny Ellis' sisters pursuing civil charges against the city and stuff like that. That's kind of the bureaucratic and governmental way of stepping into situations like this and trying to hash it out. What should the labor movement do about this? Because I can only imagine that it would create a massive schism, especially in the trade union movement, about whether or not police unions should still stay in. What's the kind of grassroots organizing that we need to do about this, I think, is the question that keeps floating in the back of my head.
Well, there's probably more than one way to go about doing this, even from the labor standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly protests, certainly walkouts if justice is not done. Certainly there are politicians that are seeking votes, withholding your endorsement as a union from politicians that won't speak out vigorously and work on these issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the labor movement definitely needs to keep the pressure up in regards to, you know, if we can't get rid of police unions, then police unions need to at least hold police officers accountable to the law, to the consequences of their actions when they don't uphold the law or when they break the rules of conduct for how they're supposed to be patrolling the streets. You know, at the very least, that is something that can be done. If we can call on the country and call on trade unions to call for a ceasefire in Gaza, then I think that that campaign for holding, at the very least, police unions accountable for defending bad police officers would be the place to start. And I think organized labor does need to recognize this as just as big of a problem. Yeah, no, it would be one hell of a campaign, to say the least, right, to try and get them out, because the police unions have definitely tried to be buddy-buddy with the labor movement as a whole by saying, look, we're workers, we provide something for society, therefore we should be organized too. And the bigger question that's being ignored is, well, what are you actually providing and why?
Mm-hmm.
Like we've said, it's to defend the material interests of employers and the business class as a whole, to protect their property, and to break strikes. That's part of police history. The police developed in the North as a way to break strikes back before the Civil War. And in the South, the police was developed in order to keep slaves in line. The
slave patrols.
And then after the Civil War, those two different factions kind of got together and started taking over each other's work.
Well, it was the movement. Now look, these are all double-edged swords. You know, if I say police reform, you know, that conjures up images in my mind and in similar thinking minds of reforming the practices of the police force, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for other people, that means an attack on the police force. And it's part of the current culture in the United States is to rush to defend the military and rush to defend law enforcement no matter what. You know, and I remember when all kinds of atrocities were going down in Iraq and the Abu Ghraib prison scandal and all that stuff, and people were conflicted because they could see with their own eyes, that don't look right. These guys are supposed to be prisoners of the United States military, not sex slaves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, that struck a chord with a lot of people, and it made people doubt some of the efforts of what the government was telling us. We're defending freedom. But why are we defending freedom when we have three kids from a Georgia reserve outfit get killed, you know, put there by United States policy? And no accountability. Same thing with the cops, and they feel free, I think. Or look, I don't want to say all cops, you know, think this way, but just institutionally, how they're structured, you know, they're going to fall on the side of all the negative instincts that capitalism breeds. And it just, I think that they should be not in our labor movement. They should have their own professional guild, if they, you know, like the AMA or something, if they want to act like that and protect and have a legal fund to protect. Don't call yourself a union.
So closing out our WAV radio broadcast today, we'd like to talk to you about some local events, previous and upcoming. Fellow worker Marilyn, it looks like you have a report back on the IWalk movie screening.
Yeah, for those of you that have heard about the acronym IWalk, that's the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee. It's a subcommittee of the IWW, and we have an IWalk committee here in Tacoma. We were contacted by Jailhouse Lawyers Speak with a request to do some education and organizing on their behalf about what prison workers are experiencing and what they need. With that in mind, we decided to do a town hall with a couple of speakers that were formerly incarcerated, that also were members of the Black Panther Party or IWW in the past. And we ended up with one speaker, some questions and answers that were done. And the second speaker, Jeff, he did his address from prison. We had him on the phone, mic'd what he was talking about, what he needed. Then we also showed an amazing documentary. The name of the documentary is Since I've Been Down. It was a documentary produced and written and done by Professor Dr. Gilda Shepherd, who is a retired professor from Evergreen, Tacoma, who had two doctorates, one in abnormal psychology and the other in propaganda and agitation.
Whoa.
And filmmaking, my favorite professor. And she did this wonderful film, documentary, centered in people in Tacoma, in Hilltop, during the 80s, and the gang explosion, and the RICO law, which targeted gang members as like members of the mafia. And three strikes, you're out. And she interviewed prisoners at Washington State Penitentiaries that were members of Black Prisoners, Consciousness Group. And it is a fabulous, fabulous documentary. She took it to Sundance. She won awards there. She has won numerous awards since there. But our branch of IWOC met at Evergreen State College Tacoma campus, and we had Mark Cook, a former incarceree and former Black Panther, tell his story, and we had Jeff tell what his demands were as a member of Jailhouse Lawyers Speak. One of their main demands was that in the prison system, since the right to free speech is denied, when you are peacefully protesting by doing a hunger strike against the conditions that you have in prison, such as lack of sanitation, such as being paid 33 cents a day because slavery is legal for convicted criminals, such as being thrown into solitary for hunger striking. Think about that.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to go ahead and show it at UW and other places too. But the icing on the cake of this whole thing was we showed the film last, kind of because we knew it was really good and we wanted people to stay during the talk because they wanted to see the film afterwards. Well, we didn't know that several people who attended were the prisoners in the film that had since been released.
Wow.
And if we have this showing again at UW and other places, we will make damn sure that we give them room to speak. Mm-hmm. They didn't introduce themselves. I didn't know they were there until after the whole thing was over. And it would have been so much better if they could have spoken their truth there.
Because in the film, we didn't know that they'd been released.
Mm. Right. And there was an article in the Seattle paper the day after we showed the film about one of the members, Camonte. There are factions that are trying to put him back in prison because he was released under a law that Washington enacted that people who were convicted of a crime when they were still underage, and he was 17, had to be granted opportunity to get out after they'd served their time. Mm-hmm. They couldn't just keep them in prison with no chance of getting out. Because, you know, Washington State doesn't have parole. Think about it.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, we don't have parole. If you've kept up with the whole business of incarceration, you know that the United States has the highest per capita level of concentration of prisoners. I'm trying to say the highest number per our population.
Per capita.
Per capita of any country in the world. And of that, the highest percentage of our incarcerated individuals are people of color.
Oh, hell yeah.
Okay. And we know, going back to the police conversation that we had, police unions, that one of the things that happened after the Civil War was the good old boys got together real fast, the plantation owners, and pushed through laws that basically ensured that they would continue to have free or almost free labor from their black population forever by way of incarcerating them and preserving slavery.
That's right.
So, kind of combined issues here. If you didn't get to see it last week, you missed a good one, but we're going to try to bring it back, and you'll have good opportunities for learning and discussing. Yes, Lynn?
Regarding IWOC, the listener may not be aware of some of the conditions that are alluded to in this discussion. One of them is that the prisoners have to buy their own bottled water, and that's, you know, and the water that they get apparently is not high quality, and there is a terrible lack of sanitation. And the fact that it used to be state employees that worked at these facilities,
but they got
in
rid
general,
of those, right?
But now they have contracted out, and apparently the quality of the food across the nation in these contracted, like one great giant corporation, I believe, that they, the food that they provide is never culturally appropriate, not even once a week or anything. It's apparently just insufferable, and that's one of the reasons that people are out on hunger strikes.
Because they have to spend the little money they have at the canteen on overpriced groceries.
Right, and to make a phone call, it's real expensive.
That's one thing the IWW does. Our branch got phone cards that we were able to send to incarcerated workers.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good idea.
Yeah,
that is really a good idea.
You're welcome to join IWOC, you guys.
Well, and I mean, I think the big important thing to highlight here is that this, all of this that we're talking about is the reason why IWOC exists.
That's
that
right.
That incarcerated workers are still workers. They are still part of the working class. They are still heavily exploited by the business class for cheap labor, which, like you said, fellow worker Marilyn,
your earphones on the airplanes. Guess who they're made by?
Prisoners.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a huge sector of the working class, which is almost completely ignored by pretty much most, if not all, of the major trade unions in this country because they deem them ineligible for membership.
Well, not only can they be members of the IWW, but their membership is free. They
yes.
have no dues.
Right, because of things like underpaying and also having to spend that money on what little groceries and accommodations they can get.
The company store.
Exactly.
So, the film specifically was about Hilltop in Tacoma and the school-to-prison pipeline, what was happening in Hilltop in the 80s, interviews with kids that are now grown up that actually came to the movie. And
we
didn't get an we didn't know they were coming and didn't schedule opportunity for them to speak. And I'm really sorry about that, but boy, that won't happen again. And since we're talking about local events, previous and upcoming, I wanted to do a shout out to the listener that March 2nd is the Poor People's March in Olympia, starting at noon, for all of the issues that poor people have. It's the Poor People's Campaign. I know the Tacoma Raging Grannies are going down. The Seattle Raging Grannies are going down. I'm hoping members of the IWW go down. I'm hoping many other union members will go down. The more of us we are down there, the stronger we are. So March 2nd, I believe that's a Saturday. Put it on your calendar. Walk, drive, ride, fly, get down there.
Something that we would also like to give a shout out as well. If any of our fellow listeners are or are not aware, Tacoma has its own labor school. It's called the Tacoma Labor School, and they host regular monthly events and seminars talking about current issues within labor organizing, how to get organized. You know, I attended a previous event late last month talking specifically about meatpacking workers in the rural South and how they fought against their employers to organize. One of their slogans was, if we can change the White House, we can change the Hog House, which I thought was a really fun slogan.
Was that Smithfield?
Yes, that was Smithfield. That was the Smithfield organizer. One of the organizers for the Smithfield campaign was there to speak.
I'm so glad you went. I think it was opposite this film event because we had several members of DSA that couldn't come because they went to the labor school event.
Yes. The Tacoma Labor School is a fantastic resource. I've met many of the people that attend their regular lectures and seminars and stuff like that. So please keep a lookout for events from them because they're a really, really cool outfit. Labor schools have a long history in this country about educating workers and the working class on their rights and how to organize and theory and philosophy and stuff like that. It's a fantastic outfit, and I have to give my shout out to them. They meet at Common Good Tacoma.
Ah.
So that's where they have the regular monthly events. You can find them on Facebook. You can find
and
them on Instagram.
And where is Common Good?
So just to round this out, the Tacoma Labor School meets at 621 Tacoma Avenue South at the First United Methodist Church. They have local labor seminars and lectures every month. They typically announce it well ahead of time. If you check on their Facebook or their Instagram, they usually put up a poster a few weeks in advance of what the event's going to be about, who's going to be speaking, what are the topics we're going to be discussing. And I think it's a great way for workers in order to get educated and potentially to help them with their organizing
campaigns. So if I go on Facebook and I type in Tacoma Labor School, I will find what I need?
Yes. So
okay, Instagram, Tacoma Labor School, Facebook, Tacoma Labor School.
Yep.
Or ask one of your friends that does Facebook to look on it and give you the information.
Absolutely.
How about out in Kitsap?
I tried to get an update of upcoming events. I didn't get any input, but we're going to be having our wobbly film night again. We're going to have it once every quarter.
Okay.
So we just got done with the third quarter movie. And so that's one thing I can keep people apprised of, I hope.
Okay.
Although, speaking of movie nights, something the Tacoma branch of the IWW is also trying to organize at the moment is a May Day movie night. Now, the details are still to be announced, but May Day is going to be on Wednesday the 1st of May this year, and we are hoping to either rent out the Blue Mouse Theater or the Grand Cinema in Tacoma in order to have a movie and a panel discussion afterwards. A couple of different ideas that we're floating right now is the fantastic 1974 documentary Harlan County, USA. The other movie that we're also looking at right now is the Wobblies documentary from 1979. I've seen both of them. They're fantastic films from an educational standpoint, from a labor history standpoint, and I think it'd be really fun for our branch to have a movie night and host it as well.
I would like to recommend the incredible movie documentary, You Gotta Move, The Story of the Highlander School. And I have a VCR version of it, but I went ahead and bought a download that I would be glad to share. Not only did Rosa Parks go to that school.
Yeah, it hurt.
But many other people who went on to organize in fighting toxic dump, in fighting mountaintop removal, and fighting radiation dumps. It's a totally, actually, I watch it every year for inspiration, and it's got great music. And it's, we have two members, well, one member. Music was very important at the Highlander School. And there was a couple, Guy and Cindy Carawan, who were musicians in residence that helped put together the song, We Shall Overcome. And their daughter lives in Tacoma.
Oh, no way. That's really cool.
Yeah. So it's a small world.
For background, the Highlander School is one of the first successful interracial in the South. Interracial organizations brought together black people, white people, immigrant people, and created community.
Right.
I read something. I forgot the name of the book, but I read it. About the Highlander School, right?
Well, actually, the bigots in the area actually closed it down because of interracial dancing, and they had to move from their location to another
location. They got burnt out, too, didn't they?
Miles Horton did stress that any time you're making changes in society, they will use calling you a communist as a way to get people to turn against you.
Mm-hmm, of course.
That doesn't mean you're communist. It just means that they're trying to shut you down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we, I mean...
That's fine, we can show ours later on.
Yeah, maybe every 6 months we could have a movie night or something.
Right, I mean, we kind of took a lot of inspiration from Kitsap County on this because they have had fantastic turnout at their movie nights, not just from IWW members, but from the general public as a whole.
Got really lucky with that. One of the fellow workers organizes punk concerts, and that's a known, the Chuck, which is the, you know, the nickname for the Charleston Theater in Bremerton, is known as a great punk rock venue. It's not exactly my genre of music, but it's a lot of fun. And it does bring people. And so we had an in on being able to get the theater. And it's a completely different experience than watching a movie or a DVD at somebody's house than to actually watch it on a movie screen.
And they got a bar.
And they got a bar.
It is a lot of fun, fellow listeners. So it looks like we're coming up to the end of our show here. I just wanted to let all of our fellow listeners know that we very much appreciate you listening in to WOB Radio. It's great that you're supporting a labor-created and labor-run organization. If you're interested in joining the Tacoma IWW, or if you're interested in organizing your workplace, please reach out to us. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us through IWW.org. They actually have a great branch search map if you're looking for a local branch in your area to organize with. And we certainly wish you all the best for any of your worker agitation and struggle out there. So, solidarity.
Solidarity
forever.